Okay, good evening, everyone. We're continuing our series on Bible building blocks. That's the class you came for, right? Okay, good. And we're a little bit more than midway through the book of Genesis, and we're going to begin Parshas Vayishlach today, and we'll see. I'd like to go through the whole Parsha today, if possible, because... So let's just quickly review the seven parshas that we have until now. All right? First parsha is Bereshis, and the main topic is Adam and Chava. I'm sorry? Gan Eden and after. Creation, Cain and Hevel. Okay, the roots. 10 generations from Adam to Noach, which leads us to the second parsha, which is?
Noach.
Main theme of Noach is?
Flood.
After that, the next story is? Tower of Babel. And then generations from Noach to Avram. Next parsha is?
Lech Lecha.
Lech Lecha. We're introduced to which character?
Avram.
And the main theme of that parsha is?
Test of Avram.
The beginning of the test of Avram, where Avram moves from being a non-Jew
to a Jew,
right? And we end the parsha with circumcision, right? Next parsha after that is
Vayera,
where Avram moves from being a Jew to a patriarch. And the big story in that parsha is the Akedas Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac. Okay, next parsha. Chai Sarah. What's the connection? Sarah dies as a result of the binding of Isaac. Correct? The main theme of that parsha is? Big ideas? If Sarah died, what do we have to do? We have to get a burial place. Maharas HaMachpelah, patriarchal tomb. After she's buried, the next agenda is that? Bride for Yitzchak, and Yitzchak marries who?
Rivka.
Excellent. We move on out to the next parsha. Now that they're married, they have to have children, so the next parsha is?
Toldos.
And the main theme of Toldos is? Yaakov and Esav, the different brothers. What important stories were there? Selling the birthright. What else? The blessings, taking the blessings. Yitzchak dealing with the Philistines is over there. Good. Last week we finished the next parsha, which is Vayetze means he has to go out. Yaakov has to go out from the land of Canaan to go to the White House, right? Face Lavan.
USA.
That's right. So he could find. And what does he do over there?
He works for
Lavan. He marries. Who does he marry? He marries Leah and Rachel, Bilhah, Zilpah. Yes. How many children?
12
children, 11 boys and one girl. And he finally leaves the house of Lavan, heading back home. Okay, so we caught up all the weeks you missed. How's that?
It took us 8 weeks. That's good.
It took us 14 weeks.
14 weeks.
So we got it down to 5 minutes. That's not bad.
No.
Okay, so now we're up to Parshas Vayishlach. So let's take a look inside over here. And we will see in Parshas Vayishlach, first of all, look how short the time span of history passes, only 2 years. The whole parsha is only 2 years. He has left Lavan's home, and just 2 years transpire over this whole story.
So that's what happens, it gets progressively shorter span.
Some more than others. This is exceptionally short. You're right, it gets shorter and shorter. But the last one was 20 years. Right, the one before that was more. The next parsha will be more than 20. But it's fitting in, very short. The overall theme of this parsha is Yaakov returning home. He ended the parsha starting the return home. He's crossing over into the land of Israel. And the whole parsha will be the various journeys till he finally ends up at the end of the parsha returning back home. And the issues that are involved with this. And another idea, which I didn't put down at the time, but as I was preparing the class again today, see, the way I do this is I first make the sheet, and then I prepare the class. And I know that's not the way you're supposed to do it, but I have to have the sheet ready first. So, but there's always things I would add. So, what this really, remember, this whole idea is Yaakov being in exile. He was the first patriarch, so to speak, who had to leave the land of Israel. And the first exile was in the house of Laban. Remember the dream of the ladder. He saw four angels climbing up the ladder, and each one represented a personal exile he would experience as he's blazing a path for the future that the Jewish people could learn to do in exile. Last week he dealt living in a non-Jewish world of Laban, exclusively Laban. Now he moves into many aspects of a non-Jewish world, but with a big change. And we'll see exactly what that change is as we go through this parsha, but we're going to learn a lot about how Jews have to deal with non-Jews, especially when we live in our exile. That's really what's happening over here. So let's take a look at the story here. Yaakov is returning home. He knows that Esav, his brother, his sworn enemy, has not forgotten that he stole his blessings 20 years ago. And as he returns, he's not sure exactly how Esav will react to his return. So he sends angels out to find out, you know, Esav knew Yaakov was returning, and to find out what Esav's reaction is. And he finds out that Esav is planning to meet him with 400 generals, and the plans are not peaceful. So this becomes the next confrontation. This becomes the next personal exile of Yaakov. He has to confront Esav. Esav is a murderer. And that's the next issue, the threat of murder. And that corresponds to the Persian exile, which we're not going to get into, but that was what that second exile of Jewish history was all about. We have to deal with the issue of murder. And Yaakov finds out that Esav really is going to go to war with him. So what does Yosef do? And the rabbis say, whenever the Jews have to confront non-Jews in any way, we are told, tradition says, review this story with Yaakov and Esav. Go over this chapter. How did Yaakov deal with Esav? This is the way a Jew, when he has to confront a non-Jew, there'll be many lessons from Yaakov's behavior, that's going to be a role model for us when we have to confront non-Jews. And that's a tradition. And therefore, you know, for example, when Menachem Begin came to New York before he was going to address the UN, so he was a little bit more spiritual than the other prime ministers. And he went to see big rabbis in New York, like Rav Moshe Feinstein, Lubavitcher Rebbe, and people like that. And they all told him, review this chapter in the Chumash, because you're about to go to the UN. You're going to deal with non-Jews, so you better go through the story of the Chumash. And throughout our history of our exile, we've had to learn how to deal with non-Jews. So we'll get a little idea of what Yaakov does to be able to deal with this. So when Yaakov finds out that Esav wants to threaten his life, Yaakov makes three preparations. Number one, he doesn't know when Esav is going to attack. So what does he do? He separates his family into two divisions. He's got one division that is on one side of the river, and another division he sends a day journey far away. And he says, in case there's war, and one group gets hit, the other one will escape. In other words, first thing in rule in Judaism when you're in exile, never put all your eggs in one basket. Because that's not good strategy. You always got to leave and out a way to escape. That's number one. Number two, he prays. He talks to God. And he says, God, I know I am now small from all the kindness you have done to me. You have done so much kindness for me since I left. When I left home, I had no money. And I come back a rich man. How I got through love and unscathed, it was only through your help. He prays to God, Hashem, please save me now. Hatzileni no biyad Achi miyad Esav. Save me now from my brother. Save me now from Esav. And he prays to Hashem to be saved. And he says it twice. He says, Esav and my brother. Why? Because sometimes Esav comes as Esav who wants to kill you. And sometimes Esav comes as a brother. As a brother, he comes with friendly ecumenism. And let's be friends. Let's be nice to the Jews. And he says, that's just as dangerous as when he comes to kill me. And he says, I got to be protected from that. And finally, the good old Shmir. He prepares a gift. A gift of 550 cattle that he sends out in a way, in many waves, to make it look like it's a bigger gift than it really is. Although that's quite a big gift, 550 cattle. And he sends that out as well. He prepares three things. He prepares for battle. He prepares with prayer. And he prepares a gift. And really, that's a manifestation, as we say in the Shema, you should love God with b'chol levavecha, u'v'chol nafshecha, u'v'chol moedecha, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your resources. So, with all your heart, we know prayer is a service of the heart. So you gotta serve God with all your heart. With all your soul, you gotta be prepared to die in battle, to fight the battle, you gotta prepare for war. And with all your resources, that's the gift. So when you're in exile, and you're not in the Holy Land, you still have to serve God that way, vis-a-vis the non-Jew. But what's most important is that clearly we don't rely on miracles. He didn't just pray. He was practical, and he did what he could to try to avoid the worst, but be prepared for the worst. So obviously, you're praying to God. And you know, whatever I'm doing, it's just an extension of my prayers. Yaakov understands he's going to battle. He's fighting a non-Jew. Of course he's got to be ready to fight him. But he's got to start, and he never knows what he's going to take. He'll attack any minute, so I got to be prepared. It could be a surprise attack in 5 minutes. So right away, he has to prepare his divisions. But immediately afterwards, he prays. Because he realizes that true success relies on my connection to Hashem. And all the physical things that I do is going through the motions, but really what's critical is my connection to Hashem. And then he sends the good old bribe. And that served the Jewish people well for many, many years. If you give your enemy a gift, there's a good chance he may just soften up a bit. And that's historically, we look in Jewish history, the Jew in exile has always had to resort to one, if not all, of those means. What do you do when the Tsar wants to impose a terrible decree on the Jews? What have we been able to do? Well, you always tried to bribe them. You would bribe officials and do what you could, because we're not in a position of strength when we're in the exile. Anything to avoid ultimate confrontation, because that means people are going to die. Yes, we would be prepared to run away, to find an escape route. It's always important to find an escape route. And most important, you have to daven. And that's the way a Jew has to have a profile when you're in the exile. It's not the same when you're in the Holy Land, you have a Beis HaMikdash, you have autonomy. Of course, you pray also when you have autonomy, but you don't have to assume, it's the middle sheet there, you don't have to assume a lower posture. You got to realize that if we're in exile, that means the Almighty isn't that pleased with us. He's not that pleased with us. And we can't have such a provocative style. We can't have, as we call, in your face to the non-Jews. It would appear that Alan Dershowitz did not read very thoroughly this chapter of the Chumash. Because Professor Dershowitz, he wrote a book called Chutzpah. And he felt the Jews living in North America, in the exile, they should have a chutzpah. You know, push themselves up to the front. We could be the best doctors, the best lawyers, and all those things. And he says, if we do that, they will respect us. And we will be able to move ahead in socio-economic status. Unfortunately, he's using the wrong tools. The Torah says not to use these tools. And he erred badly. Because as you know, his son married out of the faith. And then he got divorced. And then he married out of... Dershowitz got divorced. And he married out of the faith. So his, and he always was saying, you know, we could put our face and have the chutzpah and be proud Jews and all that. And what does he get? His own kid marries out. And he himself marries out. So it didn't quite work. We gotta realize that when we are in the exile, we don't have all of Hashem's support. We can't have chutzpah. The whole point of the exile is to do tshuva, to be better, and to have a lower profile. This goes against a lot of what you call conventional wisdom. People think if we push ourselves in front of the non-Jews, they'll respect us. They could respect us. They'll want to kill us more. Why do you think the Muslims are fighting the United States, but they're always yelling at the United States and the Jews? Because we have so much chutzpah. We think, and God says, I don't want to see your chutzpah when you're in the exile. You keep a low profile. And Yaakov understood that. Yaakov's coming back. He says, you know what? I'm going to send a gift. Do what I can to avoid any kind of war. You know, do what you can to avoid war. But if it's, and then you pray, and if at last resort, okay, we'll have to go to bed, we'll have to find some kind of an escape route. And that is the standard procedure for Jews to always do. Now, as he's preparing, he takes his children, he lines them up in a certain way, but his daughter Dina, who is a very wonderful girl, young woman, he hides her in a box, so that if Esav should come, he will not see her. Because he's afraid if Esav will see her, he will want to marry her. And that would not be such a good thing for his daughter Dina to marry Esav. We will come back to this little point later on in this parsha. Because Yaakov makes an error. And he pays dearly for that mistake. You're wondering what could the mistake be? Wouldn't any good father hide his daughter from a Hell's Angels biker like Esav? Right? Although if you learned our class last time with Rabbi Nachman, really Esav wasn't quite like that. But it wasn't a good guy. Wasn't a good guy. But we'll see. He makes an error here, which we'll come back to. Yeah?
Was Dina from Leah?
Dina was a child of Leah. She was the seventh child.
Is that part of this too, that Esav was supposed to marry Leah?
Esav was supposed to marry Leah. Good point. Esav was originally supposed to marry Leah. So perhaps he may have... So, you know, we'll tell it to you now. We'll tell it to you now, and then we'll...
Sorry.
Well, we might as well, and then we'll come back to it anyway. The rabbis say that Yaakov is faulted for keeping back his daughter from Esav. And the rabbi, Hashem says, you know, if you would have let Dina marry Esav, who knows, she could have got him to do tshuva. And now that you didn't, I'm going to have your daughter fall into another non-Jew's hands in a very ignoble way. And that's what happens in the next story coming up. And what do we learn from this story? You learn a number of lessons, but the first lesson for now is very simple. Never underestimate the power of a Jewish woman. Esav's pretty bad. You know what? But you know what? A good woman like Dina could have straightened him out. Even though Leah prayed not to fall into Esav's hands. But at this point in time, Yaakov shouldn't have resisted necessarily. Leah wasn't exactly a spiritual dynamo. She was raised in the house of Lavan. It was hard enough for her to be a half-decent person, let alone to go toe-to-toe with Esav as being a bride to him. But Dina was already the product of the tzaddik Yaakov, and now the tzaddikess Leah, who has been with Yaakov, and she's come into being, and they've been 20 years together with Yaakov now. And Dina's already, I don't know, about 7, 8 years old herself, but she has religious parents, has been raised in a religious home. And you know what, Yaakov? She was strong enough, she could have made a difference. Never underestimate the power of a Jewish woman. I always say it. If the wife wants the family to be more frum, the family becomes more frum. And if the wife doesn't, it doesn't. It's always the woman. In the merit of righteous women, we were taken out of Egypt. A righteous woman can take, not just them, it can take an Esav. It doesn't get worse than Esav. It can take an Esav and make him into a decent human being. You see? And for that, Yaakov is held responsible. Can you imagine what the, how the world would have been different? If Esav would have shaped up a bit. We wouldn't have to worry about Amalek that we're going to read about in this week's Parsha. This week about Amalek who wants to destroy us. We wouldn't have had Holocausts. A lot of things wouldn't have happened. Wouldn't have Purim. Okay. All if he would have had a different opinion there.
How is it possible that Yaakov, on his level, such a
How is it possible for a tzaddik? Because again, everyone fails to realize that when we're learning about the patriarchs, they are blazing the pathways of spirituality. There was no such thing as spirituality till Avram comes into the world. You know, we have the luxury of 4,000 years of studying spiritual history, learning from their mistakes. Right? But the truth is, he right now, Yaakov on his level, is struggling with these concepts. And he's trying his best to understand, and he's going to make mistakes because he has not yet defined and produced what the Jewish realities are yet. And he's still working on concepts of bitachon. He's starting from a vacuum. All these ideas that you know about, that you learn in Lutzado, and that you learn in Chovas Havavas, and all these things, that's coming the result of 4,000 years of Jewish history. We're talking about the very basic beginnings where the patriarchs were struggling with these ideas. To live with these ideas. And to go take your daughter, anybody here, you're gonna take your daughter and marry off the Hell's Angels biker? And so don't worry, she's gonna shape him up. That's not an easy thing to do. And Esav is a million times worse than that. So you could see why he was reluctant. But the rabbis say, God says, but you know what? You shouldn't have been that reluctant. And we'll see. We'll talk about it a little bit more. Yeah?
Was it because of the importance of Esav?
Like, Esav was an important fellow.
Did Avraham hide Sarah from Paro as well?
Avraham hid Sarah from Paro because Paro was just a terrible person, but she was never meant to marry him. Esav was part of the mishpacha.
Right, that's why I'm wondering.
Esav was part of the family. He was a descendant of Yitzchak. Can't give up on him that quick. Paro's a descendant of Ham. He's a wicked man. We don't intermarry with Hamites. But Esav's, he's a brother. He's a brother. You can't write off your brother. What if you're observant? Do you have a brother who's not observant? You just watch him go away? If there's something you can do, you gotta do what you can, everything in your power. And Yaakov had everything in his power. He had a daughter. Who knows? If Esav would have been fond of her, what a man won't do to get a woman. It can happen. So that was a problem, a major problem. Okay, he's ready to go. It's the night before the big showdown. Tomorrow morning he meets Esav at the OK Corral. And that night, as he hurries everybody across the river, he remembers that he forgot a few things on the other side of the river. So Yaakov goes back. Yaakov is alone. He's alone physically. He's alone existentially. He doesn't know if he's going to be alive the next day. The odds are not in his favor. It's Esav with 400 generals. It's like 400 generals. In a physical way, he will not. You know, try to figure if you ever watch these movies. You know, they're the cowboys are in the fort, and they're hearing that they're surrounded by like 70 billion Indians, you know, and they're going to all attack the next day, you know, and the general, you know, like General Custer or whatever says, that night before.
Custer wasn't too successful.
You know, I'm just saying, but you know, a lot of times when you know you're outnumbered, you know, or as Spock can say, they can outrun us and outgun us. So, you know, it's like, what's Yaakov? Okay, he's strong, okay. He's strong. Esau's strong too. But he's got 400 generals. So, you know, that doesn't look good. It really doesn't look good. And this is like the night before the Nazis come and take you away. Gotta get that mindset. And Vayivoser Yaakov Levado. Yaakov was alone. He was physically alone. He was existentially alone. He figured this could be the end of the Jewish people.
Didn't he know the history of I think it was Abraham defeating the kings?
Yeah, he knew there were miracles.
So
but
he had a little bit of.
But at Tzaddik, but there's bitachon, and then there's, you know, not relying on miracles. Yaakov himself said, I have been made small by all the goodness and kindness you've done to me already. You've done so. How many times can I win already? I already survived Esav once. I survived Laban. That probably pulled away a lot of merits. And who knows if I haven't made any sins without realizing it. Tzaddik is never totally sure of himself. So he's all by himself. And then the Torah tells us an angel in the form of a human being comes and attacks Yaakov and has an unbelievable wrestling match with Yaakov. Now the rabbis say this was a physical fight, but it was also and mostly a spiritual fight. It says the dust was kicked up all the way to the throne of glory. And that fight, the way the rabbis explain, was a really spiritual fight. The rabbi said it was the angel of Esav, which is better known, has many names, has many AKAs. The angel of Esav, Satan, prosecuting angel, Yetzer Hara, evil inclination. They all go together. And that night, there was an unbelievable wrestling match, a spiritual jostling match between Yaakov, who represented the forces of good, and the angel of Esav, who represented the forces of evil, and was trying to get Yaakov to give up on the game plan. And they, you know, and probably, you know, we have no idea what exactly was going on there, but there were certainly all kinds of seductions planned to have Yaakov either regret what he did or whatever. A tremendous spiritual battle took place, an unbelievable battle. And Yaakov wrestled him to a draw. And during the battle, the angel, so to speak, gave him a good zetz in what we call in Hebrew the gid hanasha. That's the thigh vein, somewhere around that part of the thigh. He moved the vein out of its place. It kind of dislocated, and Yaakov starts to hobble. But he's still fighting with that angel the whole night. And the angel isn't winning. Angel can't get away. He's not letting go. And then morning is coming. The angel says, "You gotta let me go. Gotta let you go. Why do I gotta let you go? Because it's my time to sing before God." And an angel only gets to sing to God once in its existence. And I gotta do my performance now, so you gotta let me go. So Yaakov says, "Before I let you go, you gotta bless me." So then he says, "Okay, I'll bless you. I bless you that you no longer are gonna be called Yaakov, but you'll be called Yisrael." And then, yeah, he asks him, "What's your name?" "My name is Yaakov." He says, "No, you're going to become Yisrael, because I see you've been able to fight valiantly against all kinds of forces, and you're going to be Yisrael one day." And then Yaakov says, "Tell me your name." And he says, "Why do you want to know my name?" And then he lets him go. Very strange story. Very strange story. What's his fight? Is to let him go. Can you imagine if you're an angel, and you get only one time in your lifetime to sing to God? Let's say you had your one chance to play in the Metropolitan Opera, right? Would you go pick a fight with some gang leaders on some side street the night before? Wouldn't you probably, be in a nice hotel room, sleeping in, rest yourself up?
Go to bed early,
or maybe you'd even sleep in the opera to make sure you don't miss the boat. And what's happening is angels got to talk to God tomorrow, sing to God tomorrow. He's picking a fight with Yaakov the night before. So what's the story all about? So the story's all about, you know, we think there's good angels and bad angels. There's no such thing as good angels and bad angels, because every angel's on God's payroll. And that good angel, that angel here had a purpose. His purpose was to see, could he get Yaakov to regret everything he's been doing? Can he find a way to get Yaakov to sin? And the whole night, he's struggling with him. And the whole point of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, his whole job is to try to get us to sin. That's his job. That's what God pays him for. Right? It's his job. So in the most critical moment of his life, he's trying to get Yaakov to sin, and Yaakov, he's not losing. He's holding an even match. He can't get him to sin. Gives him a zets on the thigh a little bit, but he can't get him to sin. And then he says, "Okay, you gotta let me go and sing to God." So what does that mean? The answer is, when the angel sings to God, that means the angel has accomplished its mission. Did the angel accomplish its mission? It did. Because, you see, God gives us a Yetzer Hara to get us to sin. But the whole point is, we're supposed to resist. And he's supposed to try harder, and we're supposed to resist harder. And ultimately, he should try to throw everything and the kitchen sink to get us to sin. And Yaakov didn't give in the whole time. The angel said, I succeeded in my mission. Because eventually that angel is supposed to bring the sanctification of God's name. And the fact that Yaakov resisted and held on, that sanctified God's name. So the angel says, time for me to sing to God. But then Yaakov says, but wait a minute, you know, Mr. Yetzirah, I've been fighting with you for so many years. Before you leave, I want to know one thing. Tell me your name. What does it mean, tell me your name? Tell me your name means, tell me how you work. What's your modus operandi? Because I'd like to be able to bequeath to my children and teach them how they can fight the Yetzirah. So if you tell me your M.O., then I can give that as a tradition to my children. We'd always know how to defeat the Yetzirah. So what is the answer? Why do you need to know my name? And that was an answer. Because the answer is, I don't have any particular modus operandi. It depends on the person I'm sent to. And it's very simple. Your Yetzirah is different than your Yetzirah, than my Yetzirah, and your Yetzirah. Because Yetzirah does one thing. Looks at your weakness and attacks the weak spot. And therefore, when the Yetzirah comes to you, and your weakness is... Oh, I'm not saying you. Your weakness is you're lazy, let's say. He'll find a way to use your laziness to turn you down. He goes to you, and your weakness is you can't say no to people. He'll hit you on that. So when people want you to sin, you can't say no. And your weakness is you always get angry, so he'll find a way to tick you off and get you angry. He doesn't have the same name. Don't ask me my name. It's a different job depending who I have to go to. So he says, you know what I am? I am your spiritual trainer. I'm your spiritual trainer, right? Any people go for training? What do you call it? What do they call it? The personal training? Go for personal training? Anybody? You go?
You used to go.
So what do they do? What is a personal trainer? You ever go? No? I had one. I had one for a season to learn how to lift weights. So what does he do?
He gears the program to fit
you, and then what else is doing? He looks for your weaknesses. Right? If your biceps aren't strong, so guess what exercise you're doing? Biceps. Right? And as soon as you can pick up, if he thinks you can pick up 10 pounds, then he gives you 15. Just when you thought you could do what you could do, just when you're feeling great about yourself, I could pick up 10 pounds 15 times. So then what does he do? The last time he says, you know, no, let's make it another 10 pounds. And then, oh, I'm dying. Because he knows just how much to push you. Because the more I push you, the more I make you flex the muscle. And the muscle gets stronger. The Yetzirah is pushing your spiritual muscles. He says, that's my job. And how do I push the muscle? I find the weak spot. Where you're the weakest, that's where I will attack. And that's the one that's going to have to make you work the hardest. That's the way I work. And if you'll find in your life, you never get rid of it, dear. That's correct. Because you don't want to get rid of it. If you get rid of the personal trainer, then you don't work harder. I don't have a personal trainer now, so I take it easy. I never push myself. I don't have anybody to spot me either, so I would get killed if I did try anything more than that. But you know, yeah, I'm not in the mood to really push too hard, you know. Bench press 135, that's enough, and I'm not gonna push myself anymore. But if the trainer was there, he'd put another 20 pounds on me. Push me a little more. So it's to your benefit that the Yetzirah keeps pushing you. Keeps testing you. And when every time you overcome, you get a little stronger. And then he comes back the next day with a little bit of a harder test. And just because you thought the test was like this, and you figured out the Yetzirah, you got him down, guess what he does? The next day comes from a different place. Because when you work, let's say you're working on your patience, and you're so patient, he can't get you angry anymore. And you're really feeling good about yourself. So what you do, he finds another weakness, and he goes to a whole new battlefield, which you're totally not prepared for, and you fail miserably. And then you gotta start fighting in that area. That's how the Yetzirah works. And that's what Yaakov finally understood. He said he's 99 years old by this time of the story. Remember, he got the blessing at 63. He hid for 14 years in the Yeshiva Shem Ve'Ever. He's been away for 20 plus two more years. He's 97 to be exact. He said, for 97 years I've been fighting with you and I still can't figure out what your way is. And he comes to the new insight. It depends where your weakness is. That was a daybreak for him. And remember last parsha, the sun set 2 hours early and he had to pray the Marav prayer because he was in the dark. And now the next morning the sun rises 2 hours early because Yaakov gets a daybreak. He's been going through all this darkness. I don't understand why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? Why am I having to go to Lovin's house? Why did that my wife switch? This, that, it's all in there. I don't know what's going on, but now I understand it's all part of a plan. Hashem is flexing my muscles. He gets a daybreak. And so to speak, the sun heals the limping of the foot that he was limping with. And now he's ready for his confrontation with Esav. Yes?
Sorry, just because of that vein, you can't get a leg of lamb.
Yes, because of that vein, you can't get a leg of lamb. Almost, that's true. So there is a mitzvah. Whenever there's a critical event in the history of the development of mankind, we recognize it with a new mitzvah in the Torah. If you think about it. The Noahides started with 6 commandments. Then after the flood, God gave Noah the 7th commandment to not eat the flesh of a living animal. And that's all anybody had, 7. Comes along Abraham, he becomes a Jew. What's the next mitzvah? Circumcision. Another mitzvah. Right? Now Yaakov, we're going through a critical point because now we're going to see shortly, Yaakov changes from Yaakov to Israel, and we're going to see that has incredible importance. So a future development, which we'll explain more in a minute. So now a new mitzvah, Gid Hanosha. You can't have that 5 vein in the animal's legs. We're not allowed to eat it. Now, if you know, and you're an expert, you know how to remove it. You have to be an expert to know how to do that. Then you can eat it. Otherwise, you can't have the leg.
In any animal,
the Gid Hanosha, that vein, that sinew. So some places, South Africa didn't know how to do it, right?
They did.
Oh, they did not. Okay. There's enough kosher food, they just try to stay away from those areas, you know. But, and that, there is a missing. You don't know about this because you only get the food that's kosher now, you know.
There's part of the cow would that be?
Right, the leg, certain part of the leg.
Some
say it's the sciatic nerve in that area, okay. You don't know about this because you've never seen the inside of a leg of a... But there are people who have to be trained. It's called nikur in Hebrew, where they have to train how to pull the nerve out. You got to pull it all out. If it breaks in the middle, it's somewhere in the middle of that leg. You can't use the leg. And since it's a very difficult process, a lot of people say, listen, we can get rid of... We'll live without the legs. We'll have other parts of the animal. There's a lot. No. So anyway, there's this myth. It's called Gid Hanosha. Now, let me read for you a minute from the Sefer HaChinuch that tells us the reason for this mitzvah. Now, you perform that mitzvah every day. You buy kosher meat. You don't even realize that. When you don't eat those parts of the non-Jews, you know, the rump roasts or those things. Like all these, there's different things we don't eat of certain animals because there's different fats that the Torah doesn't allow. It's very complicated. I don't want to get into that now. But this is the specific, this Gid Hanosha, this thigh nerve. So the rabbis say the root of this mitzvah is that it should always be a reminder for the Jewish people that even if we go through many sufferings in the exiles through the hands of the non-Jews, and specifically the hands of the descendants of Esav, we should always have trust in God that we will never be lost. But there will always be a Redeemer who will save the Jewish people. And to remember this, right, we have this mitzvah. And every time we eat animal meat and we avoid eating this, we remember the story with Yaakov. Okay. And that Malach who fought with Yaakov, we know was the angel of Esav. He wanted to uproot Yaakov from this world and his children out of the world, spiritually, and then that would have been physically, and he wasn't able to. Can you imagine fighting against an angel? But he hit him in that thigh bone, so to speak. And continually in history, the children of Esav will always try to inflict pain and try to destroy the children of Yaakov. And at the end, just like in this story, there'll be a daybreak and the Jewish people will survive. Just like the sun rose for Yaakov and that sun healed his wound that he had, so too the son of the Mashiach will come and heal the Jewish people from all our wounds, from all of history. So that's why we don't eat that. So that's with Yaakov. Yeah?
Who would have been
The descendants of Esav? Germany.
Germany is Yefet.
No. Germany. The Gemara in Megillah says, Esav hu Germamia shel Edom. Germamia. That was in the 400s. That's what Germany was called. It was Germany. And others. What?
Semite. They're also Semite.
Of course. Of course they're Semites. Esav's a Semite. He comes from Shem. That's right. And so that's and other Europeans can maybe fit that bill too. Okay. And we see historically Germans have done quite a job on the Jewish people.
Anti-Semites are Germans and Arabs, which are
from Yishmael, of course. The Chinese we don't have to worry about. Not yet.
Chinese of Kaifeng.
Okay. But anyway, but that's clear. There's always Esav. That's what in this week's Torah portion is Parsha Zohar. We have to always remember what Amalek wanted to do. That's the Purim story. There always are people who are selfless. You can tell a descendant from Esav is someone who wants to kill the Jews even if they will die in the process. That's a selfless anti-Semite. And that's usually a good indicator that they're from Amalek. And there's no shortage of them around in the world. We also learn another important lesson. That before any physical battle, there is always a spiritual battle. You gotta learn the rules of life. The spiritual rules of life are, before a Jew will find himself in a physical battle, he will find himself in a spiritual battle. And depending on what the results of the spiritual battle are, that's gonna be the results of the physical battle. The physical world always parallels the spiritual world. So Yaakov's gonna meet Esav physically. There's a threat of physical life that only can be if there's a spiritual threat first. And how we deal with the spiritual threats will determine how we're gonna deal with the physical threats. So, when you have spiritual threats brought by the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, and the Jews found a spiritual threat in the 18 and 1900s, and what was the Jewish response to the spiritual threat? Unfortunately, an amazing failure. That's when Esav came as my brother. And in Germany, they said, come, we'll give you freedoms. We'll give you rights. You come to our universities. You can marry our daughters. You can be playwrights. We're sophisticated. We love you. Come. That's my brother, Esav. And he comes as my brother, Esav, and every Jew says, oh, that's wonderful. Let's give up our Judaism. So we lost the battle with the angel of Esav in the 1800s and the 1900s. And when you lose the battle, it's only a matter of time until you lose the physical battle. You follow? I'm oversimplifying this. I'm really oversimplifying this. I'm not doing justice to the oversimplification, but that's what's happening. And that's, you gotta always be worried. When there is always a spiritual holocaust before a physical holocaust. And if you see a spiritual holocaust, there must be a physical holocaust afterwards. There's no two ways about it. If you see a spiritual revitalization, then there'll be a physical revitalization. It goes hand in hand. America is the next step. Like I said, you don't want me to talk about this. It gets everybody depressed.
Okay, five.
You know? It can't be this. So much assimilation in America that one day the Americans aren't going to kill us all. And the Canadians, it just can't. History has so many times said it over and over. This is what you learn all the time. That's why we learn Torah. To remember, this is what's happening. You got 70% intermarriage rates in North America. It can't last forever. When we finally lose that spiritual battle, the physical battle is the next one.
I read that there's a statistic that says that there are more young Jewish men studying Torah now than there has been in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
There is.
That must be a good thing.
It's on the one hand, there's a lot of Jewish people learning Torah. That's true. But we never had the kind of assimilation that we had either.
Which one's stronger?
So what do you think? There were a lot of very religious rabbis in Poland in 1939. A lot of religious people. And they all went to the gas chambers together with the German Jews who assimilated. Why? So not taking away from the very beautiful Torah that thousands and thousands of Jews are learning, but how many of them are reaching out to their Jewish brothers and sisters? And how many are insulating themselves away from their treif cousins, not to be influenced by them? How many of them are putting themselves in a box so Esav doesn't see them? So you're right. We have so much Torah never before. So why aren't they all at least knocking on the door? Hello, my name is Shmerel Schwartz. How about learn a little Torah with me? You know? And if they slammed the door in your face, okay. At least you tried. But why are you putting everybody in the box? Right? That's the problem. So Baruch Hashem, Yaakov won this spiritual battle. It's the same thing as the Purim story. Right? We're going to read the Purim story in less than a week. What happens? The Jewish people, they're trying, how are we going to survive? The king's inviting us to a party. The food's kosher. But of course it's an amazing sex party. And it's going to seduce us and all other things. But at least the food is glatt kosher. Mahadrin mina mahadrin. It's unbelievable. In fact, people are running around without any clothes. So listen, they do it in Miami too. Glatt kosher places and women got almost no clothes on. You know, maybe they even had more clothes on in Shushan than what they have now. Right? So they took pleasure from the feast that Achashverosh made. So once they took pleasure, they lost the spiritual battle. So that brings strength to who? Haman? And they would have been annihilated. They were that close from being annihilated. What happens? The Jews got back and we had to fight another spiritual battle. And they all went and did tshuva. An unparalleled tshuva movement in the time of Mordechai. Unparalleled. He took all those Jews who were giving up their Yiddishkeit and he averted the Holocaust. You see? So that's it all came from the story. There's always a spiritual battle to be fought. If we lose the spiritual battle, the stakes are high. And that doesn't mean, and of course, that means all of us Yaakovs out there are going to get hit in the thigh. Now, what's the thigh symbolic of? Let's think about it for a minute. What is the thigh symbol? Look at my, or your body. I don't like so many people looking at my body, but you could yours. You got, the thigh basically is the base that keeps the structure up. Says the Chofetz Chaim, what is this symbolic of? Symbolic is financial support for Judaism. You're gonna have a Jewish day school, a yeshiva, that wants to teach Torah. Now, the Torah's up here, right? From the mouth. Putting on tefillin, davening, the hands. But what, you cannot survive unless you pay the rabbis. The teachers gotta get paid. You gotta keep up the dormitories. If there ain't no money, there ain't no Torah. So what does the Satan do? He cuts you at the leg where the source of the support that stands you up, and that's the money.
Just above the wallet.
That's below, right where the wallet is. That's where the wallet is. You got it. So meaning to say that we'd understand that the struggles we'd have to, remember, Yaakov's strength is the voice, the Kol Kol Yaakov. We're learning Torah. That keeps us going. But if there's not financial support, we can't keep these places going. So what happens? What, you ever find a Jewish institute that's rolling in dough? And that's what Yaakov had to go through. He got hit in the foot, meaning symbolically in the future, the foot, the financial support will be weakened, right? And still Yaakov fought. And that's what we're going through right now. Wouldn't our Jewish institute, wouldn't we do better against, in this fight against assimilation, if we had millions of dollars at our discretion? If you gave me $10 million, I'd know what to do in Toronto. I would pay people to go to shul. If I put a sign, you get $100 a Shabbos. Every Shabbos, you get $5,000 at the end of the year. You think I'll get some bites? And that's all it is, $5,000. And if they went to Shabbos for 3 years, they'd probably be religious. So what's the cost? $15,000, $20,000, and they're religious. You know how much the Christians are paying per Jew to convert them to be Jews? The millions of dollars they're investing to missionize on Jews? I'm not talking Jews for Jesus per se. It's those, just those nice, friendly, fundamental Christians who make friends with Jews and help out those poor Jews. Give them financial support through their crisis because we love you, brother. Right? They're spending per Jew. I forgot the number. It's in the large thousands per Jew. They got the money. And you go to our Jewish institutions and the schools are struggling. A school raises the tuition by $1,000, 200 kids drop out of the school. Because of money. Okay? And we have to fight. And the Jews have the money. And we've got lots of money. Not giving the money. So that's the struggle that Yaakov was dealing with. And that's the hint for the future. But Yaakov still fights even if he's hurt. You see. So Yaakov wins this battle. He wins. That's incredible. And when he wins this battle, then the next morning, Esav comes. Esav comes running to him, running. And Yaakov's strategy is, as he's coming to Esav, he bows down to him. And he bows down to him. And he bows down to him. To show that he's giving him honor and respect. Oh, since when can you bow down to another person? So the rabbis say, but he saw something else. Yaakov saw something else. As Esav was running, he saw on top of Esav the divine presence. On top of Esav. So when he bowed down, so Esav thought he was bowing down to him, but he's really bowing down to the divine presence. Which is really saying God knew, Yaakov knew that Esav only coming with God's power. And if I could surrender myself before God, then Esav won't be a problem. And Esav comes, and we know he has a momentary change of heart, and instead of killing Yaakov and fighting with him, gives him a big kiss. A big hug and a kiss. Although the Medrash says that when he hugged him, he then wanted to bite him. But Yaakov's neck turned to marble and Esav's teeth were blunted. So even when they want to kiss you, you gotta be careful about that. Whenever a non-Jew wants to be your friend, be careful. He's hugging you, but there's a bite waiting behind the neck. Okay? And then Esav looks at all these children, he says, my goodness, what's happened here? Oh, these are, I thought you were the spiritual one. I see you're a wealthy guy. You got lots of kids. And in those days, kids was wealth. He says, how did you come up with all that money? Well, Hashem blessed me. What can I say? And then Esav says, oh, that those animals he gave me, I don't need them. I don't need them. I have a lot. And Yaakov says, no, please, it would be a great honor for me if you took my guest. Well, I don't really want to. No, why don't you take it, Yaakov? Well, I have everything. Yeah, but I have a lot. But please, take. And eventually Esav takes the gift. Because Esav says, I have a lot, but he didn't say I have everything. Yaakov said, I have everything. Because a Jew knows whatever I have is everything I need. Esav said, I have a lot, but if you persuade me, I might go take a little bit more. And Esav, he takes the gift. And the whole discussion, Yaakov keeps saying, oh, please be kind to your servant. He calls himself a servant in front of Esav. He really sweet talks him, because he knows I'm in exile, I gotta watch it. Can't be confrontational. And then Esav says, okay, it's nice, I see your whole family, he doesn't see Dina, she's in the box. And Esav says, okay, where are you heading? I'm heading back home. I'll tell you what, I'll escort you. Yaakov says, this is not a good idea. He could change his mind any minute, and who knows what I'm going to pick up from that guy if I hang around him. So he gives an excuse. Says, well, the kids are weak, and the animals are going slow, and you're a tough guy, and you go fast, and, you go too fast one day, people, will get hurt. And I appreciate the offer. Thanks, but no thanks. Please, I really want to... No, really, you're a guy who goes fast, and, we're going to slow you down, and you know, it was nice meeting you, Esav, and, you know, maybe we'll see you some other time. And he says, fine, suit yourself. He goes back to his land, which is in Mount Seir, which is a little bit of southeast of Israel. And it, miraculously, one day he leaves, and Yaakov, whoosh. Before Esav realized, a day later, he says, how come I let him go? It's too late. Too late. The moment passed, and the moment was lost, and he couldn't deal with it anymore. And then Yaakov travels on to a place called Sukkot. He stays there for 18 months to let his family develop a little bit further. And then he moves on to the next story. Okay? Shechem and Dina. Now, on his travels, he travels to the city of Shechem. For those that are familiar, Shechem is now called Nablus. Nablus is in the, what do you call that? The lower northern part of Eretz Yisrael, on the eastern side. So that's Shechem. Shechem was inhabited by heathens. The king of Shechem, his name was Hamor. Hamor means donkey. And his son was called Shechem, and he named the city after his son Shechem. And Yaakov comes, and the first thing he does is he decides, I'm not buying in Shechem proper, because that's a bunch of heathens. I'll buy it. He purchased a piece of land just on the outskirts of Shechem. First lesson he teaches us, when you go to Eretz Yisrael, it's important to own a piece of land in Eretz Yisrael. You should always try to have a piece of property in Eretz Yisrael. He buys a piece of property there, and he notices that they're really heathens. So Yaakov comes in, and as he's living there, he establishes certain things that they didn't have. He totally changes things. First of all, they had no market economy. So first he develops a coinage. He also develops bathhouses. And he also develops marketplaces. They didn't understand these concepts. A bunch of heathens. And he takes them to the club, somebody walk away with it, right? So he says, no, guys, you know, we can do things, it's called a free market economy. You ever heard of it, guys? No, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, you know, you're a farmer, you come with your stuff, and you sell your stuff, and we use money, and we trade, and, you know, you could really get to learn to live with other people. You don't have to just steal their stuff. You know, you could be productive, and you work on your farm, and you got all these cantaloupes, and you got all this wheat, and instead of me stealing your cantaloupes and you stealing my wheat, you know, I'll sell you some, and for money, we can get along really nicely. And you know, you're also a bunch of filthy people. He doesn't say them like that. He says, maybe you should wash yourselves a little bit and go to have bathhouse and have some kind of sanitation. So he was trying to help these people. Okay. You see, we're beginning to see Yaakov's posture. We have to deal with the non-Jewish world that we're living in. We can't totally ignore who they are. Anyway, while they made the sale of the property that Yaakov buys, Shechem and his father, they come into Yaakov's house to bring the contract for the deed, to sign the deed. And Shechem notices in the house, says, who's that pretty woman there? Oh, that's my daughter, Dina. Oh, okay. Is she married? No, she's not married. Okay. And Dina's just staying on the corner. No. So Shechem figures, you know, I like this girl. Yeah. Well, you figure, why keep her in the box if she's in the house, right? So Shechem comes up with an incredibly devious plot. And what does he do? He gets all the young maidens to make a parade out in the street. And Dina was a lot like her mother. The mother was quite forward. You recall when she was able to sell the flowers for the right to be with Yaakov, she went out to the fields to tell Yaakov to come to her. And he suspected that Dina, if she would see all this music and the girls singing and dancing, and they're going to sing and dance in ways that they maybe shouldn't, that there's a good chance Rachel, who would try to go out to the girls and tell them maybe they should behave a little differently. She tried to reach out to them. So meanwhile, him and some other people will be waiting in the corner for a surprise attack.
But Dina, you mean?
I'm sorry?
Dina.
No, Shechem and his friends.
No, but who would tell the girls to
Dina. Leave? Dina would go out.
Like you said, though.
I'm sorry. Dina would go out and see what's going on. See if she can help these girls. So it was. The girls are dancing. There's music. She goes out. They turn up the music really high, just like the mafia does. And then they a bunch of guys capture her. She's screaming. No one can hear because the music's loud. The brothers are out in the fields watching the sheep anyway. And they capture Dina. He captures her, and he does many things that is not proper to be done to a Jewish woman. So, this is now the punishment for Yaakov. You didn't want to let your brother marry her in a kosher way? Don't worry, someone's going to get to her anyway. So the brothers come back. So Yaakov finds out about this, and he can't react. He can't react. He can't do anything. He waits till the brothers come. The brothers come and say, this is ridiculous. This is terrible. It's unheard of. Such a thing to happen to the Jewish people? It's unbelievable. They have to figure out a strategy. What are we going to do with them? Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Shechem, after taking part of Dina, initially it may have been something out of a lustful idea, but he began to see she was really a wonderful woman. And he begins to develop a feelings for her, real feelings for her, and he wants to marry her. He says, Dad, can I marry her? How can you marry her? She's a Jew, you're not a Jew. It's unthinkable. He says, come on, Dad, I'm a spoiled brat prince. Aren't you going to do what I want? He says, okay, I'll do my best. I'll go to Yaakov and I'll talk to them. So Hamor goes to, and Shechem goes to Yaakov and says, you know, you guys are new here. We're established here. You know, my son, he really likes your daughter. So I don't see why they can't get married. It'll be a very nice thing. And you know what? I'll tell you what. We'll give you all the privileges of being a Shechemite. You know, we have all kinds of laws, and strangers aren't entitled to all these privileges. We'll give you, you know, property rights. We'll give you zoning rights. We'll let you marry our daughters. We'll really treat you like anybody else. What do you say, Yaakov? Yaakov's not answering. The brothers answer, and they say, you know, that's not a bad idea. But, you know, there's a problem, you see. We're Jewish people, and we have a rule. Our daughters can only live with people who are circumcised. So if you want this to happen, you'll have to all circumcise yourselves. And then we can really live together. Plan it. So Shechem thinks it over, Hamor thinks it over, says, okay, we'll go back to our people, and we'll get back to you. So they go back to the people, the house people, and I say, well, how did things work out after you violated the daughter of Yaakov? What did they have to say? Well, they were very nice about it all. Really, all we have to do, we're going to have all the benefits we want because they're bringing lots of wealth into our economy. It's good to have these Jews. They bring a lot of wealth. They help any economy. And, you know, we'll give them certain rights, and then we can marry their kids, and we can have all these wonderful things. And the only little price we have to pay is get circumcised. What? We're all going to get circumcised? What's the matter? We're going to get circumcised? Oh, come on. We can do this, guys. And then they say, and by the way, once they get really comfortable with us and they think that we like them, then one day we'll turn around and kill them all. And we'll take all the women and we won't have to worry about it. Okay. It's not a bad idea. You see what's happening here. If you don't realize this, this is the first terrorist act written in the Torah. And what we're learning in this story is, how do Jews deal with terrorists? That's the story. It's a terrorist act.
You mean the kidnapping?
The kidnapping was a terrorist act. And how to deal with it. So they come back to Yaakov, the sons say, okay, we agree to the circumcision. Great. Okay. Tomorrow, go get circumcised, and we'll prepare the wedding plans in a week or so. So, they all get circumcised the next day. And then we know, after the third day of circumcision, everybody's very weak. So at that morning, Shimon and Levi decide to pay a visit to the town of Shechem. And they pay a house call. And they go to every, how you feeling? Oh, I'm dying. That's great. Well, we'll put you out of your misery. And they go and they kill the entire city of Shechem. All the males. In one shot. They find Dina, you're coming with us. How can I come with you? I'm an outcast now. I've been defiled. Come on, you come with me. We'll take care of you. And they take her back. They come home. They tell their father what happened. They're so proud of themselves. Well, we avenged that one. We took care of that. We took care of that. Then they're going to learn not to mess around with us Jews. And Yaakov said, How could you do that? Well, what do you mean? They violated one of the seven Ohad laws. One of the seven Ohad laws, you're not allowed to kidnap. And all the people there watch it and condone it and do anything to stop it. And according to the Noahide law, they deserve the letter of the law was get killed. So I understand that, but you didn't go and tell them that. You went and made a whole shtick with them. And you told them in good faith, they thought that they would become, they could be with us. And you went and killed them like that? You have dirtied my name in the eyes of the world. And Shimon Levy, don't beat an eyelash, and said, do you think we should treat our daughter like a whore? End of the chapter, end of the story. Yaakov doesn't respond. So who do you think won the argument? You think they did, but not really. So there's a lot in this story. What do you see? There's always two theories how to deal with terrorists. Do you deal with them honestly or deal with them not honestly? Shimon Levi felt you deal with them not honestly. Yaakov said, you know, you deal with them not honestly, you don't make yourself a good name. What eventually happens, they move on, they leave Shechem, and all, he says, if all the nations hear about this, they're going to come and try to attack us and kill us all, and we're just one little people, we can't go against all these people. And so it was, as soon as they left Shechem and were on their way to further on, a number of nations went and started attacking the Jews. And only through Yaakov's prayer, a miracle happened that the Jews were saved from that. Now, there's a lot of things to talk about over here. Were they right? Were they not right? A lot of issues here. But what do you begin to see as we're moving on, as Yaakov is developing into Yisrael, something very special is happening. Yaakov is a patriarch. Yisrael is a nation. And what's happening, the Jewish people, as they're coming back to Israel now, they are leaving what we would call a patriarchal society and are becoming a nationalistic government. And there's a big difference between a patriarchal society and national government. If you're just a bunch of patriarchs, you can't really make a big difference in the world. But if you're a nation with a kingdom and a realm, then you can impact on the world. And as they're becoming a nation, they're beginning to interface with the rest of the world, and they're seeing it's not such an easy task. And as much as we, you know, when you're just a patriarch, you try to be a nice role model, but you really don't take responsibility for policing the world. But if you become a Jewish nation, you have to begin to police the world, and policing the world is not such an easy job, is it? And you try to police the world and try to tell them it's better, and they may even rape your daughters. And then you got to make some difficult decisions. Now, the fact that Yaakov didn't argue with them doesn't mean he concedes. We'll see at the end of the book of Genesis, he reserves his final words for them, and he tells them a lot for them to think about. But, so Yaakov now has gone through another great personal exile with this story of Shechem and Dinah. This will correspond in the future to the Greek exile, where there's a tremendous threat of immorality. And this story is sandwiched in to the next story where Yaakov will journey to Bethel, where he will get a new name, where God officially calls him Yisrael. Now just one last point and we'll end with this. So why does he get this punishment that his daughter gets raped? We said because he withheld Leah from Esav. So what was the problem? The problem is like this. Yaakov has to realize he now is coming with a force of holiness. He's a tzaddik. He's developed himself perfectly now. He took all the qualities of Yaakov, all the qualities of Esav. He now has the attribute called Tiferes, where it's a beautiful blend of everything. And Yaakov has to believe that the power of good, when you represent God, is so powerful, with a head-to-head confrontation against the power of evil, good has to always win. Because you're carrying godliness with you. And with an honest confrontation between good and evil, good has to always win. And Dinah, who carries all the good of the family of Yaakov, if she would have to have a confrontation with Esav, good has to win because you have the power of God behind you. And since Yaakov wasn't sure about this, God has to teach him a lesson. It says, if you ever think that the power of good isn't strong enough, then maybe it isn't. And look what's going to happen to your daughter. And sometimes God throws it back in your face to learn that lesson. Now you're going to say, but is he supposed to let his daughter marry such a heathen? So one answer is yes. Another answer says, you know what? Maybe no. But one thing's for sure. When he closed the box, he didn't shed a tear over his brother Esav. Yaakov could have said, you know, I have a wonderful daughter, Dinah, and I wish Dinah could marry him. And if he was at least a little bit open to any kind of spirituality, Dina could make him a better person. But he's so close, nothing's going to happen with him. So you know what? Regrettably, with tears, I closed the box. I wish it could have been different. But he didn't do that. He said, good riddance to bad rubbish. And to that, God said, even if you have to not help your brother, you should have shed a tear for me. You didn't. Okay, there's more to talk about. We've gone overboard. We got to stop.